Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/ACAST, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Randomly Generated History Club, where three non-historians pick a year at random and try to learn things about it. I'm Anna, and I'm here with my two friends, Ant and Will.
Hi.
Hello.
And this week, we're so excited. We have a very special guest joining us. This is a Randomly Generated History Club first. We've got Paul Bavel from the excellent podcast History Rage. Welcome, Paul.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me. I don't think I've ever been described as very special before, so I'm touched.
You're very special to us.
Yeah.
Paul and I met at the Mike podcast convention type online meetup thing. It's effectively this, like, you know, where podcasters go and try and learn things about podcasting as opposed to history. And Paul very graciously said that he'd be a guest on our podcast. And he is, of course, an esteemed board member, so being involved in History Rage, which is a fantastic podcast, by the way. History Rage. Paul, why don't you describe the podcast?
Okay, so it's kind of started by accident in that we tried to do some video work somewhere, and we had the idea of let's grab historians and see what pisses them off. So we invite historians on, and there can be, you know, podcasters, YouTubers, authors, museum curators, people like that. And we ask them the one rage question, which is, what do you just wish everyone would just stop believing? And
so awesome.
The tidal wave of just historians that come out of the woodwork to go, right, this. I mean, we've done episodes like The First World War is not the poetry. The Battle of Britain was not a close-run thing. The Battle of Waterloo isn't all it's cracked up to be. Probably our biggest, most contrary, the one that caused the absolute Twitter meltdown was Spitfires, not really that great.
But they're so iconic.
I know.
And they
sound
so beautiful.
I was expecting, because we just released at time of recording last week, we did the Boston Massacre wasn't a massacre. And the Boston Tea Party wasn't really all it was cracked up to be either. Yeah.
It definitely wasn't a party.
Yeah. You know, 43 tons of tea in the Boston Harbor and Britain cries out milk in thirst, you heathens.
I love it.
But yeah, that's every week where we've got one. So
yeah, so all our listeners, you should definitely listen to this. It's a great podcast to listen to actual historians, not like the three of us just rambling on.
There are actual people on there who know what they're talking about.
We get so worked up about things. So imagine how worked up we'd be if we actually knew what we were talking about. It would be great. So this is going to be great. We're talking about a massive year in history, 1942. So many things you could talk about. So I actually think it's great that we've got four of us covering it. And of course, we always start the episode by giving a three-word preview of what we're going to talk about today. So Ant, can I have your words, please?
Love is propaganda.
Nice.
It's words to live by. And Will?
Women fly now.
was that so a good. Command or
could be.
And then Paula, have you prepared your three words?
Spaniard, cons, Hitler.
Ooh. Ooh. Okay, great. That is excellent.
And then, a reasonable person to con. I think you're allowed to con.
Yeah, as far as conning goes. My three words are, thanks for Bluetooth.
Oh, okay.
Yep. Good.
Yeah, sorry, I'm talking about 942. Is that not right? No, 1942. Here we go. Okay, so today I'm going to tell you the story of Hedy Lamarr, a popular actress who had a pretty unlikely and unusual side hustle.
Hedy Lamarr. Hedy,
Hedy Lamarr. So Hedy was born Hedwig Eva Maria Kiesler right. in Vienna.
No, yep. Actually Hedwig.
Actually Hedwig. Thought that was maybe just for owls, but apparently it's for ladies too. And to a Hungarian Jewish family. And she was really interested in acting and modeling from a young age and eventually got some work in the, what I can only imagine to be burgeoning Vienna theater scene in the 1920s as an actress. And then in 1933, when she was 18 years old, she starred in a film called Ecstasy, which was her big break, but also came with a heap of controversy.
Because of all the drugs?
No, because of the other thing that you get in trouble for in movies.
Not having drugs.
Not having drugs. Ecstasy showed a close-up of her face during a moment of passion, let's say. A moment, the throes of ecstasy, you might say.
What, and during prayer, her love of God? I don't understand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and some people didn't like that. There were also some nude scenes, and this was 1933, so that sort of stuff doesn't fly, even in Europe, even
that was
here
before,
in
before nudity, wasn't it?
It was before what?
Nudity.
Yeah, before nudity was invented. No. Yeah. But despite the controversy about her starring in such a salacious movie, it still gave her a lot of traction. The movie was banned in America because, you know, we're all a bunch of Puritans. But she still managed to make her way to Hollywood. And she meets a Hollywood studio head who changes her name from Hedwig, which is your first mistake, because what a stage name. But changes it to Hedy Lamarr, puts her on a $500 a week contract, and starts promoting her as the world's most beautiful woman.
Wow.
A title she held until 1986 when I was born. And she does a bunch of Hollywood films in the 30s. She's typically typecast as this sort of glamorous seductress of exotic origin, exotic being Vienna, I guess. But Hedy had always been interested in inventing things, strangely. Her parents weren't inventors. She didn't have any sort of formal training, but she would always kind of like tinker around on projects in her spare time. And when the war started, she read somewhere that radio-controlled torpedoes might be developed and used by the Allies. But the problem with radio-controlled torpedoes is it's easy to jam their guidance system because you can block the frequency of the radio waves.
Yeah, just play music loud enough, I think, and they probably divert.
Exactly. Yeah. Like those the Tokyo anti-loitering noises that they blare.
Are those the ones that, like, only people under a certain age can hear?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm 50 this year. I've never heard these.
You're torpedo-proof.
Yeah, you're absolutely torpedo-proof. So Hedy heard about this problem with the radio-controlled torpedoes and said, okay, I'm going to figure out a way to overcome this. Because why not? So now enter a man named George Antheil. So old George was born to a family of German immigrants in New Jersey. He flunked out of high school, a great start, and started to work as a composer, which I think is the 1920s
this
equivalent.
Is the worst, like, set of people to invent anything. What does a composer and a beautiful woman think they're going to do? Not saying that beautiful women can't invent stuff.
Yeah,
I'm just saying.
The dangerous comment there.
Let's dive into that
outrageous.
One.
Careful. Completely outrageous.
I'd like to go on history rage right now.
Is your rage going to be Ant and his just old-fashioned Victorian attitudes?
Aunt has been my rage for so many years. So George Antheil flunks out of high school, starts to work as a composer. He's really into like avant-garde atonal music. It really is. I listened to some of it while I was doing my research, and some of it is beautiful. Some of it is challenging, let's say, tonally. I found something that said he often injured himself when playing piano because he would like throw himself at the keys so hard.
Wow.
And he also used to do a thing where he would pull out a revolver from his jacket pocket and put it on the piano during the concert as a way to be like
this or else.
Yeah. Or just like, ooh, look how avant-garde I am. I put a gun on the piano.
Isn't this like the early 30s where kids carry guns?
Yeah, that's true. Yes. That's true. He pulls his out. Everyone in the audience pulls theirs out. Yeah. So I don't want to spend too much time on his orchestral work, but you should look him up. He's a real character. And I do have one quick story. His most famous piece is called Ballet Mécanique. And when he staged it for the first time, he had this elaborate staging with, you know, background and all these weird instruments and machines. And one of the machines he had hired was a wind machine, which I guess was part of the soundscape. But when they turned the wind machine on, it blew so hard that the audience members had to clutch their hats and their programs, and the, you know, kids had to clutch their revolvers. And one gentleman in the audience tied a handkerchief to his cane and waved it wildly in the air in a sign of surrender, saying, like, please stop this music. But George was undeterred, despite, I would say, slightly cool reactions to
people
his...
do that to me in meetings at work. They just wave a handkerchief on a stick constantly. I know.
Stop bringing your fan machine, I think, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't have a business case. Will, you should just stop it. So eventually George realizes there's not a lot of money to be made in the world of avant-garde piano compositions, shockingly. So he moves to Hollywood to compose film scores. And on the side, he's also a writer. He wrote a murder mystery. He wrote a book of war predictions called The Shape of the War to Come. I was unable to verify if any of his predictions were right, but I assume they were all bang on.
That would be a pretty interesting horoscope, right? If it was
just Luxembourg, Caesars East Asia.
Miss 100% of the shots you don't take, right? It's true. He also wrote a memoir called, and this is going to be sad for you because this title is taken by George, Bad Boy of Music.
Oh, gosh.
So you're going to have to come up with something else.
I really want that one, though.
But my favorite thing is he considered himself to be an expert on the female endocrine system, so hormones and stuff. And he wrote a book about
how can you be male and an expert on female hormones?
Also with like less than a secondary school education, no scientific training of any sort.
Never had a girlfriend.
Just has the wind machine.
Inapproachable music.
Totally. But he's an expert, and he writes a book about how men can determine whether or not a woman is available based on, quote, glandular effects on her appearance.
Wow.
And this book had the incredible name, The Gland Book for the Questing Male.
Wow.
The bad boy of the glands.
Yeah.
That's horrendous.
he's a real bad boy of the glands. Fascinating character. I love this guy. So he's doing his thing. He's questing for women and composing for films. And he meets Hetty at a cocktail party. And apparently she sought him out to talk about how she could improve her shape. And then, quote, he suggested glandular extracts, but their conversation then moved to torpedoes.
That is a first date conversation. I would have married her right there.
If someone approaches you and starts talking about your glands, you're going to reach for any topic of conversation you want.
Yeah, so anyway, torpedoes, I guess. So with this like wonderful meet cute in mind, she explains the problem with the radio controlled torpedoes to him. And together they come up with the idea for something called a frequency hopping signal. And they literally sketch it on the back of an envelope, possibly the first instance of that happening. And what they do is, so you guys know what player pianos are, the ones that play themselves. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they play because they have this perforated because of magic.
Yeah.
And now we'll cover your ears. There's a perforated tape that has the keys that need to get hit by the piano. So George and Hetty take that idea and basically say, if you could print out a tape like that, put one copy of it on the torpedo, keep one copy of it in the ship and synchronize them, then it's a really unpredictable range of frequencies because it's got to cover the 88 keys of the piano, and anybody trying to jam that signal wouldn't be able to jam preemptively all 88 keys. That's pretty clever. It's pretty cool, right? Yeah.
And also, you're now giving away secret technology, Anna, so NSA is going to come knocking on your door pretty quick.
Oh, God, I think they're here. Well, this has been fun. Bye. So George tracks down an engineering professor at Caltech to help them build it. Hetty starts to work with lawyers on a patent application. Sorry, patent. That's how you guys say it. Patent. And in August 1942, they patent it. Unfortunately, the Navy, the U.S. Navy, is not interested. And anyway, electrical controls were about to make radio kind of obsolete. And okay, fine. Some other scientists and inventors had maybe already considered this.
Here we go. Yeah.
But in the early 60s, the Navy did eventually adopt the technology, conveniently after the patent had expired. And then from this launching pad, a lot of other people did experiments and built upon that work. And it's possible that this work on frequency hopping signals was later incorporated into Bluetooth and GPS and Wi-Fi. So right now, you are probably listening to this podcast on a technology that may not have existed without the input of the world's most beautiful woman and music's baddest and most glandular boy.
Amazing.
Do a quick Hedy Lamarr fact for you there as well.
Yes, please.
That we're all of a certain nerd culture here. I will accept. Sure. So the lead villain in series 2 of Agent Carter, Whitney Frost, totally based on Hedy Lamarr.
Really?
Oh. Yeah. Nice. Beautiful woman, actress, scientist,
torpedo expert.
Yeah. Creates weapons. Yeah.
There was some controversy because in Blazing Saddles, there's a character named Hedy Lamarr, and it's intended to be kind of a satire, but it really pissed off the real Hedy Lamarr, who like tried to sue Mel Brooks. And that part made me sad because anybody who takes umbrage at Blazing Saddles is no good in my book. But yeah. I'm overlooking that because of the other things she did. Cool. So, yeah, that's Hedy Lamarr.
He sounds great.
And George Antheil.
Who sounds less great?
Who sounds less great? But you know what? I think he's got some real good ideas on glands.
Okay, so my section for 1942, Love is Propaganda, which is also the name of my EP. Buy it now in stores close to you. First of all, to understand the extent of the phenomena we're about to discuss, we need to take a step back through time, which is what we're doing already, but we're going to step further back and briefly explore the history of propaganda itself as a concept. So propaganda dates back to the ancient world, I'm assuming, where it was used to spread political or religious views. However, it wasn't really until World War I that propaganda in its sort of modern connotations and form takes place. And this the modern and systemic approach to spreading your message. And this is primarily driven by the emerging field, the evilest of all fields, public relations, or PR. So PR was pioneered by a chap named Edward Bernays, a nephew of none other than Sigmund Freud.
Oh, I thought you were going to say a nephew of the guy who invented the sauce.
I was totally with you there, Anna, as well. I was coming in there.
I was going to say cousin of Mary Peppercorn.
Yes, he is the cousin of Mary Peppercorn. But he used his uncle's insights and his rich, creamy sauce and insights into the human minds to manipulate public opinion. So Bernays, he is actually the one that successfully branded bacon and eggs as the all-American breakfast. So he did this when working for the pork company, and they're like, hey, no one's eating pork all the time. How do we increase pork? And then, so what he did, he went to 10,000 doctors, said, sign here, get some money and say, bacon's really good for you. What do you know? Pork is now on the menu. Looks like bacon's back on the menu, boys. Bacon and eggs, all American breakfast.
That makes so much sense, just as an American and as a person who understands PR and who loves bacon.
He also had the noble task of trying to get women to start smoking because they didn't really gel with it. And the packaging for this company was green, and that was an uncool color at the time for whatever reason. I don't know why. Green is really cool, I think. But what he did was he actually got designers and fashionistas to actually start making clothing and wearing this dark green color, and also pictures and newspapers of women smoking and looking very cool. So he also branded cigarettes Torches of Freedom.
Oh, God.
Nice.
Really, really jingoistic in his ways.
Oh, God.
I love that he made green happen instead of just changing the color of the packet.
Well, apparently that was too expensive. So changing the production line was too expensive. So that's why he did it. Anyway, Bernays, his influence was so profound that he was actually dubbed the father of public relations. And he actually used the word propaganda himself and tried to take that word back, but it didn't really work. But his strategies were widely used during World War One to rally public support. And they set the precedent for governments worldwide to get stuck in. In World War One, the Committee on Public Information was responsible for propaganda, and they relied heavily on the medium of posters. And they also sent thousands of volunteers. So these men would volunteer to work for this committee. And they were called the Four Minute Men. And they were called the Four Minute Men because they would have prepared 4-minute speeches that they would give at local bake sales, libraries, you know, public forums, espousing the virtues of war. I got my nickname as the Four Minute Man for other reasons, but we won't go to that. By World War II, things had progressed significantly. The now named Office of War Information had become much more significant. And they worked in lockstep with another body called the Office of Strategic Services to spread messages to promote the war. Now, does anyone know what the Office of Strategic Services went on to be?
Oh, yes.
Julia Child's employer.
Yes, the CIA, Central Eye Agency. I is for information, I think.
Probably not quite right.
No, I think that's quite right. Whoever they are,
don't identify them. They work in the shadows.
Yeah, I've already got the NSA on me. We don't need the CIA on you.
So now it's much more sophisticated. They wanted to spread the message, not just to promote the war internally, but also get the populace on side with their messages for, like, you know, donating to the war effort, government bonds, donating your pots and pans and like your hosiery for some reason.
Yeah, save your nylons for your victory garden.
But what? Why? I don't know what they use nylons for. Like, I have no idea what they were doing with that. It just seems a bit weird that some guy was collecting them. I was like, yeah, it's for the war.
Of course it is. Yes.
Anyway, they also now worked on sort of this, what they called black propaganda, which was disseminating false information in Germany, fake radio stations, all that kind of stuff. So it's like really, really interesting side of things now. So one of the key tools at their disposal was, of course, still posters, whereas it's very poster heavy. For example, my favorite one was a picture of a man driving a car, and the car has no passengers except for the ghost of Hitler. And the caption says, "When you ride alone, you ride with Hitler." And this is in an effort to conserve fuel.
Wow.
For the war.
Oh, I see.
Oh, no. I live alone. Do I live with Hitler?
Yes, you do. You've been living with him all this time.
Oh, God.
You're fueling Hitler. But what they also did was they worked extensively with Hollywood. So first of all, they were just using Hollywood and the resources there to make pro-war films and propaganda, promoting the messages, you know, denote your pots and pans, etc. But they also started to have influence in popular movies that were undergoing, because there was funding, there was military advisors, and there was just a general zeitgeist of like, let's get on this populist bandwagon. So it's kind of a sort of a meeting of minds rather than like, you know, the OSS or CIA saying, do this thing for us. It was a little bit of both.
Yeah.
So it's the opium of the masses, and what could be more massive than the next big blockbuster, Casablanca.
Ooh.
So Casablanca, massive film. A lot of people may not have seen it, but you should, even though it's in black and white, and you've got your no attention span. But briefly, Casablanca is a romantic drama set in the backdrop of World War II. directed by Michael Curtiz and starring the Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman, one of the most beautiful women of all time. It follows the story of Bogart, who's Rick Blaine, an American expat who runs a nightclub in Casablanca, Morocco. And this was sort of a center where people would come to try and flee the war and get back to the US. And he's sort of running the show. He's very jaded. The Nazis play a part in it as the grip of North Africa takes hold. Anyway, it's really stunning. It's this love triangle. Rick used to date this woman called Isla, who's
Ilsa
Bergman. Isla.
Ilsa. You got it.
Oh my God, Isla.
You're just carried away by the romance of North Africa. I know how you get.
But she also has, she's actually with Laszlo. So she used to be with Rick, but because she thought Laszlo, who was a freedom fighter, was killed. Laszlo comes back from the dead, effectively. Rick runs off to Casablanca. He's a jaded man, runs his gambling den, and he's staying neutral, true to no one but himself. Just classic kind of goodness. So, but turns out, lo and behold, they show up in Casablanca trying to escape to America, and Rick is faced once more with the love of his life. And then eventually at the end of the movie, he chooses to make the ultimate sacrifice by giving up his space in the plane so that Laszlo can escape and continue the good work against the Nazis.
What's the statute of limitations on spoiler tags for,
there are spoilers for this.
I don't need to see the film now.
Yeah. That explained it so well. But, you know, the jaded Rick's character arc completes, and it resonated with the people of time, you know, highlighting that really sort of classic heroic tales, giving up for the greater good, and about the ongoing North Africa campaign, etc. Some great moments and lines in this, you know. And this was actually, interesting enough, the film was being written as it was shot. Mm. So everyone on the set didn't know what the hell was going on. Years later, Ingrid Bergman would say that it was a complete chaos, didn't know what was happening. And they actually shot two different endings. They shot one, which is Rick letting her go off and saying the famous line, apparently improvised, "Here's looking at you, kid." But they also filmed the other way, where he gets on the plane, like, you know, "Here's looking at me, kid," to Laszlo when he gets on and flies off.
And, wow.
But this was influenced then saying, oh, it's actually more, you know, patriotic if he gives up his seat.
A lot of people think I'm the Laszlo of this podcast. I've heard that a lot. I've heard that five or six times. Carry on.
I think you're the kid.
I think you are. Anyway, so Casablanca, assisted by the US and was generally pro-war sentiment, portrayed the heroic struggle against fascism, communicated the need for personal sacrifice for the greater good, which was exactly on message for the US government at the time. So Casablanca, while not, is effectively a propaganda vehicle for the US. And that's, of course, where propaganda and Hollywood and the US involvement there ends and never happened again.
E.T., right? which is the most blatant pro-US propaganda.
Actually, kind of yes, because films to this day, if you are shooting anything with military hardware, you can go to the US Department of Defense and they will allow you to shoot on aircraft carriers, get into jets, you know, have, you know, guns, advisors, whatever it is you need. They'll actually lean in, and they've got a whole sort of department dedicated to reward media relations. The only gotcha is that they want to have a little editorial control to ensure, quote unquote, accuracy, i.e. censoring anything that might be bad and promote anything that might be good. Also, in terms of sort of influence and propaganda to this day, did you know that the Department of Defense has an esports team? They play
really?
Online video games, or at least they had one. Until there was an issue with Twitch, because they were on Twitch and people were coming on and trolling them and saying.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
stuff, like linking to a Wikipedia article of like list of US war crimes and stuff and saying, which one's your favorite? Like just trolling them. And so they would then ban these people. But then there was a court case because it's a government entity. It's therefore a public forum and First Amendment rights kick in and you cannot ban people for this. So they're like, we don't know what to do. And they kind of just basically shut the whole thing. Anyway, Casablanca, 1942, love is propaganda. That's it. That's it. That's
Rick is streaming on Twitch. He's crushing orcs on League of Legends or whatever.
You don't play video games.
I don't. Yeah, that is accurate.
You mentioned there the whole thing of them having that Department of Media Relations, and you can go and get in a plane if you want to. Yeah. Do you know one of the films that they refuse to support?
No.
Independence Day. One of the most pro-American films absolutely out there. But they wanted them to remove all references to Area 51.
Wow.
Oh. And that cost them the support. So all those fighter aircraft that you see there were CGI'd, apparently.
I wondered why Area 51 wasn't how I remembered it.
You didn't have the probe, that's why.
Yeah. Oh, you would have been great had Randy Quaid not been available. I just also can't think of a more pro-US line than punching an alien and saying, welcome to Earth.
USA.
USA. It's so good. Oh, great.
Okay, so my slot then kind of moves nicely on from Ant's slot there, where he talked about black propaganda and putting out fake stuff, because Spaniard cons Hitler. 1942, a man, and I apologise to any Spaniards in your audience, you can get on Twitter and murder these three people for how I screw up your language.
We've given up on
good. Yeah, they hate us already, it's fine.
So this is a man called Juan Pujol Garcia. In 1942, he is brought to the UK by British intelligence. He is known to British intelligence under his code name of Garbo, because they give him that because he's such a great actor. And he's known to the Germans under his code name of Alaric, because they actually take operational security pretty seriously.
There's no relation to that person.
Exactly. Now, again, we need to do a little bit of a step back in time here to give the background to who Garbo is. Basically, he is a Spanish ham radio enthusiast. And being Spanish, he has seen what fascism is capable of. So
does
he's
he call it Hamon radio?
Oh. Oh, you see, oh, they have all the different types over there, though, couldn't it? You know.
Yeah.
But he has got... what he does, he's seen like fascism firsthand. He's fought in the Spanish Civil War. He's quite aware of like Guernica and all that sort of thing, and he wants no part of this whatsoever. So pretty much at the outbreak of war, he wanders into the British embassy and goes, hello, I would like to spy for the British working against the Germans.
Wow.
And they go, hello, no.
I mean, like, I don't know how that's worked, because I've gone to every single embassy and done the same thing.
Yeah, maybe you're just a Spanish ham radio enthusiast, but he turns up, they go no, which is, to be fair, it's a pretty understandable reaction when you've got a guy who is a national of a fascist country that has declared neutrality. You might want to think twice about bringing him on. So he goes, well, all right, then. He turns around and swans out. And a couple of days later, he goes to the German embassy and goes, hello, I would like to work for the Germans spying on the British. And they go, come in, we will have you. And so they start to pay him as an agent, and he builds this network of agents all across the British war effort. So you've got like fascist sympathising dock workers, and you've got like sympathetic secretaries, disgruntled sailors, all of these people that are feeding information about the British war effort back to Garcia, who is then encoding it and sending it on to the Germans. 27 agents in total he has under his command.
Nice.
And they all have one thing in common, which is none of them actually exist. He's totally made all of them up. They exist only in a small filing cabinet that's by the side of his radio set.
Oh, was he getting like paid per agent?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He's got an expense account that finances 27 agents. And he is just making shit up and sending it to Berlin. And Berlin are absolutely loving this. They're taking all the notes down and everything like that. He occasionally makes some real screw-ups, which if it wasn't for the fact that the Germans knew less about Britain than he did, it would have been royally screwed. So, for example, he claims that he has a Glaswegian docker who will do anything for a litre of wine.
For our American listeners, Glaswegian probably doesn't reach to wine, first of all.
Or litres, you know. Yeah. These are, you know, I love my Glaswegian friends, but honestly, if you said, would you like a brandy? They'll say, yes, give us 2 pints of that, you know. And the other one that he does as well is he seems to assume that the British Parliament basically takes the summer off and goes to Brighton. Because this is pretty much what the Spanish Parliament do. Yeah. The Spanish Parliament closed. God, don't we wish Parliament would just close down for 3 months?
Yeah, it would save everybody a lot of trouble.
But the Germans, of course, their best insight into what's going on in the UK is Garcia at this stage. We pretty much capture every German spy that they send, partly because we know they're coming, partly because we've got this whole deception operation going ourselves. But we managed to find that. It's also partly, I have to say, because the head of the Abwehr doesn't really like Nazis, so keeps sending the shittest agents he can. There are 3 people that are arrested for cycling on the wrong side of the road while speaking Portuguese. They landed in Scotland. And so he keeps sending all this stuff back. Meanwhile, he's taking all this money. And then in 1942, he sends information that reroutes an entire submarine pack to an area of the Atlantic where there isn't anything. And it's at that point that British intelligence think, hang on a minute, this guy's up to something. So they track him down and they say, yes, come along, you can work for us.
Yeah.
And they bring him back to the UK.
Keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah. This is great. The great thing is, they don't even have to pay him. Yeah. He's being paid by the Germans.
Amazing. For this,
to keep a bit of the credibility in amongst this network as well, he occasionally has them like arrested and then shot in the Tower of London.
Oh,
and you can get newspaper articles that are published to announce this as well,
sorry,
so they can.
The fake people,
yes.
Are being read.
So fake people are now having fake executions.
Oh, wow!
Which leads to by about the end of 1943. He is actually living off 3 Reich pensions that have been awarded to the widows of his fake agents that were fake shooting. This guy's stunning,
brilliant.
Isn't it? And, so he keeps sending all this stuff in. And we jump forward a little bit in time now, because 1942 is when he's brought to the UK, but he's very, very involved in the 20 Committee. So the grand deception operation that's going to, when we go in for Operation Overlord, is going to have the Germans go, look over here, and definitely don't look over there. And he's not alone in this. There's quite a few people doing deception operations and other bits of sabotage. And if I've got time, I will tell you about Flight Lieutenant Richard Fletcher. This is an aside from Garbo, but this is awesome. This is the most British thing I've heard in the war.
Great. Okay.
Flight Lieutenant Richard Walker, absolutely obsessed by pigeons, eccentric even by MI5 standards. Okay, so bonkers, even MI5 put him in a back room and just let him rabbit on about pigeons to his heart's consent.
He's already the most British person I can imagine.
Exactly, yeah. However, he manages to get the green light for his idea from a particularly drunk Churchill.
Oh, God.
So he comes up with this idea and goes, right, he puts a call out to the great British public and goes, send me your shittest pigeons. And the British public respond in absolute droves. And there's like crates of pigeons being delivered to MI5 headquarters. And so forth. And they actually invent a new method of soldering so that they can perfectly replicate a Third Reich pigeon ring. Because an awful lot of like Abwehr communication is done by carrier pigeon.
Yeah.
Oh.
So they then, in advance of D-Day, drop shit pigeons all over France. And of course, your German agent is going to go, hello, God pigeon, God secret message. I will place it in this very nice leg ring here, attach that, fling it up. And of course, pigeon goes up in the air, swans off to the next field, sits down, doesn't go anywhere.
That is actually brilliant.
Yeah. And you've got in amongst that as well, you've got the occasional good pigeon, because you can't rely on the British public to do everything right.
Right.
So what happens with the good pigeons? You put the secret message in, buggers off back to England.
Wow. I love that so much.
But yes, I digress, as we keep saying on History Rage. So you've got in the build-up to D-Day, pretty much the day before D-Day, so just as everything's getting to go, they're wondering how they're really going to convince the Germans absolutely that D-Day isn't happening. And what Garbo does is he transmits to Berlin almost the unvarnished truth of what's going on. So he's got troop numbers, he's got ship types, he's got when the departure times. He sends it just a little bit too late to really be able to do anything to stop it.
But not too late that he doesn't have to give up his pensions.
Exactly. But also, he just puts a little addendum onto the end of it after he's given pretty much the entire plan of Operation Overlord. He then throws a little postscript to it with the words, "This is just a diversion."
Oh my god.
And they have this moment where they're sitting in a flat in Balham waiting for a confirmation signal. And pretty much about 2 o'clock in the morning, they get the signal back that Germany's bought it. And they keep like a shit ton of panzer divisions in the Pas-de-Calais region waiting for an invasion that's going on in Normandy as they're waiting. And so convinced are they, is Hitler, actually, that what Garbo is telling them is true, that there is at least one panzer division, possibly even as many as four, that don't move out of that region until late September of 1944.
Oh my gosh.
Now, you know, what happens in late September of 1944? We invade Holland. You know, we've gone round those four panzer divisions, you know, encircled, destroyed everything in the Falaise pocket and headed off to liberate the rest of Europe. And still they're waiting for an invasion that just isn't coming.
They trusted him so much.
Yeah, after the war, he faked his own death and went to live in Venezuela.
That's the only way this
ends. He actually went to live in Venezuela, quite ironically, in amongst an awful lot of the Nazis that he spent the war deceiving.
Yeah,
that's incredible.
He did come back to receive an OBE. For his war work, but I believe he died before the bulk of his work was actually declassified as well. Wow. He died in 1988, but it's just like one man and a radio
that
can
amazing.
Just divert the entire Third Reich. Is
incredible. Thousands of lives just by those actions.
Oh, yeah.
Like caused the war effort to be a success.
Yeah,
it's huge impact. Yeah,
I hope they knighted all the shit pigeons too.
That was fantastic.
Yeah, that is amazing. I love stories like that because you just think they're so outlandish, and just the like gumption and the courage to do something like that and have it all come off is amazing.
Yeah, well, I say like we do these things that are the most British thing ever. I think we should do more than that. There should be somebody sat in like the Ministry of Defence at the moment that's going, you know, shit pigeons. Let's give it a shot.
Listen, if they want bad ideas, they should listen to this podcast.
We charge a small fee as a strategic consultant, but there you go.
Perfect.
Okay, this week I'm going to talk about the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, or WASPs.
Lady stuff.
Exactly, lady stuff, precisely. Women
what
fly
their
now.
Like?
tell us about their glands.
Don't. This
it's not bang on relevant center track, the whole thing. But okay, so this is an organization of civilian women pilots who undertook non-combat missions for the US military during the Second World War. And the story is basically just packed full of like, the most amazing women who were just basically battling to be able to effectively just serve their country during the war and to overcome the sexism that was just like completely prevalent at the time. So the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, the WASPs, so they existed to try to free up male pilots who were allowed to be trained for combat missions and allowed to serve in those roles, to free them up to do exactly that so they could go off and fly in combat. And it was formed from two other organizations. So you had the Women's Flying Training Detachment and the Women's Auxiliary Ferrying Squadrons. These two other organizations, but they were both, and they, yeah, so flying training and ferrying was what they were allowed to do, speaks volumes.
Yeah, definitely. And also, I'm just trying to think of those acronyms, the WIFTIDs and the WAFs.
Exactly, yeah. The WIFD and the WAFT, the WAFs, yeah, that didn't take off. Both of which were organized like totally separately in September 1942, and then they were then merged the following year into the WASP. And they flew in the end like over 60 million miles. They transported basically every single type of military aircraft going. And they did the sort of stuff they were up to was things like towing targets for live anti-aircraft gun practice.
How long was the tow line?
Yeah,
that doesn't sound like a fun job.
Presumably, like very, very long, right? I guess
it would have really to be. Incompetent gunner.
Yeah. They did. They simulated strafing missions to gather data on sort of like attack angles and things. They transported cargo, basically anything not facing the enemy, and they were doing it. And over the course of the war, 39 WASP members lost their lives in accidents, and one probably due to enemy action. Although no one ever found out what happened to her. And the story, the creation story of it, is basically emblematic of the whole organization and of the kind of women involved. So one particular woman, this woman in 1939, this woman called Jackie Cochran, she wrote to Eleanor Roosevelt, the first lady at the time, to suggest the idea of using women pilots in non-combat missions. And Cochran was then introduced by Roosevelt, who saw the letter and read it and acted on it, to the head of the Air Force, the chief of the Air Force, a guy called General Henry Arnold, and to another general called Robert Olds, who was head of the air transport bit of the Air Force. And Arnold then, having a referral from the First Lady, sort of gets the attention of that person. But also he then does quite a lot to kind of champion the cause, which I think he didn't necessarily have to do. So you've got to give it to Arnold to some degree. So he then asked her to ferry a bomber from the States to Great Britain that was being donated by the US, or not donated, I guess, like lent and had to be eventually paid back by the Americans.
Thanks. That's right.
The idea was that she would ferry that over, and then there'd be a bunch of publicity because of, you know, it would be a woman flying this plane, which was such a novelty. As it was at the time. So it worked. So Cochrane did it. She flew to America, to England. And then when she was there, she actually volunteered for the Air Transport Auxiliary, the ATA. So this was this is the British civilian organization, which already existed.
They're known as the Atta Girls.
Exactly. Yeah.
Were they really?
Mm.
That's great.
Great name.
This is like a civilian organization already existed. And she was an American joining it. And then she then recruited a whole bunch of women. So more than 25 women in the end to come and join the Atta Girls. And they all went over to the UK and were flying, and were flying there. And those women who did that were the first American women to fly military aircraft. And basically this was then a really like formative experience for them all, when they saw how the Brits were doing it, and the way in which women were allowed to do these things already in the UK was actually a step ahead, or took a couple of steps ahead of the States at the time.
Yeah, I mean, you can't just, like, in a total war, you can't just give up half of the population from doing vital jobs and roles. So, like, sexism, unfortunately, had to take a back seat for a while.
Just for a while, though. We got pretty back to it pretty straight after the war.
It comes back later in the story, yeah. Don't worry. Yeah, so quite quickly, actually. And then in the summer of 1941, Cochrane and then this other test pilot called Nancy Harkness Love, who is another amazing woman, then independently submitted proposals to the US Army Air Force, the Air Force at the time, to allow women in non-combat roles to fly in Europe, and to requesting permission for that. Just a note on Jackie Cochrane, by the way, just to give you an idea of how cool some of these people were. So Jackie Cochrane then became, after the war, she became one of the most prominent racing pilots of her generation,
cool.
including the men. She's super cool. She broke a bunch of flying records. She was the first woman to break the sound barrier. She's pretty cool.
Don't all women break the sound barrier? They always be yapping, you know what I mean?
Oh my God. It's like, we can't, none of us can comment on that at all, obviously. It's dangerous.
You know what? If someone watched me in a bar and she was like, you know,
don't say the thing you're about to say. Okay, yeah.
No, I would just swoon. I would be completely putty.
Yeah. Yeah, it's absolutely. Very, very, very cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then she then had her own very successful business career, and then personally sponsored the Mercury 13, which was this privately funded group of women astronaut candidates who underwent tests in the early 60s to try and prove that women could, you know, could become astronaut candidates in the official program and go to space, which was like widely considered to be just impossible, purely just because, well, you know, they're women, of course they can't go to space, was basically the level of analysis at the time. And so she then, you know, so she was just a pioneer and kept on pushing women forward in this like general aeronautical field for the rest
of her
life.
What was her name? Jackie Cochran.
Yeah, cool. Super cool. A bit more on the WASP. So the WASP members, they were basically all US federal civil servants, basically, you know, so they were civil service employees. They weren't military personnel, so they didn't qualify for any military benefits like the male pilots. Every member had to pay for her own accommodation, transportation to like their training sites. They had to buy their own uniforms.
They should have invented and then killed fake husbands to get their pensions.
Yes. And the whole time their flying record was quite clearly as safe and reliable as the men's, you know, so there was no evidence. The evidence base building up was really like then helpful later on for when women were eventually allowed into to fly missions and fly more in the US Air Force. But the media at the time were absolutely not very supportive. So there are publications like the Times, the Washington Post, like a whole bunch of others, like at different stages published editorials and allowed articles to be published, all urging women to sort of give the jobs back to men. Mm. So they sort of framed it as women taking the jobs from men.
Spare men floating around during the war.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there was absolutely, so generally the prevailing voices at the time were not particularly in favor. You know, it was very, very conservative. And there was even a column that just in classic fashion accused the general as being, you know, as having succumbed to Cochrane's feminine wiles and having been seduced by her, there's absolutely no evidence for it. And then what happened eventually, as Anna, as you said, is that sexism returned to the story with a vengeance. So on the June 21st in 1944, when you would have thought people were generally quite keen to maintain capacity in all these missions, given like, well, D-Day was a couple of weeks before. There was like quite a lot going on at this time, summer 44. But anyway, the US House narrowly defeated a bill in their wisdom. The US House narrowly defeated a bill to provide the WASP with military status. And the organization was then wound up quite like, but they started taking steps to wind the thing down. And eventually, it wasn't, so the US Air Force did offer commissions to the WASP, former WASP pilots, but not until 1949. Four or five years later, and about 120 did accept the commissions and did then become regularized officers in the US Air Force.
Nice.
But they were all given support and admin roles still. So they were still not allowed to fly. And it wasn't until 1993 that the US Air Force finally allowed women into fly combat roles.
There was a part of me that wondered if they were even allowed to fly combat roles today.
Yeah, they absolutely are now. And same in the UK, in the British, in the Royal Air Force as well. But yeah, 93 though was finally the year when it happened.
But the British Army only allowed women into the infantry relatively recently. I think in the past 5 years or so, maybe.
Yeah, very recently.
Right,
But there you have it. There's the WASP. So like hugely groundbreaking achievement. But
and all of the really
sky.
Depends how hard you land.
breaking barriers. Yes, there you go. WASPs, there you go.
Nice, very cool. I like how we talk all of our things talked about the war, but we not just like a battle.
I mean,
I'm proud of us.
In our defense, a lot of stuff happened in 42 that was basically just the war. I did find there was a highway in Alaska that was open.
Oh,
but I couldn't go back for 10 minutes.
There's probably a library in Lewisham that had a village fete or something. You know?
Yeah, we'll do that. We'll do those the next time the random number generator gets on 1942. Well, thank you so much for joining us. That's everything you'd ever need to know about the year 1942.
Yes, and before we boot up the random number generator, I just want to thank you specifically, Paul. Thank you so much for coming along.
You're welcome.
You have a fantastic podcast. So what's coming up in your world next?
So at the time this goes out, we'll be looking at just kicking off series 8.
Wow.
Yeah, so we've got, I can give you a few ideas of the rages that are coming up there.
Yeah.
AI reconstruction should be burnt.
Okay.
It wasn't the First World War that got women the vote.
Ooh.
Montgomery, not all that. And the one I'm really looking forward to, which is Bletchley Park didn't win the intelligence war on its own, you know. So that's just a small collection of
spicy
what's coming out in series 8.
Yeah, wow, that all sounds amazing. So all our listeners, please go listen to History Rage for a much classier and
actual information. We are not that classy, I can tell you. And do have a look out. It's not absolutely confirmed at the moment, but myself and Kyle, my co-host, may be appearing live at the Gloucester History Festival at the end of September as well.
Nice.
with a live History Rage show.
Oh,
Gloucester History Festival, check it out.
I know,
guys.
That kind of
so
sounds like a team field trip, if I'm being honest.
I think we can expense this, right?
Yeah, oh definitely. It's all a write-off. Okay, that means that all that's left for us to do is get our next year. So, Will, can you do the honours, please?
I absolutely can. And as a reminder, we've set the random number generator to choose a year between 1000 BC and 2000 CE. And the next year is
1712.
Okay. Any hot takes on 1712, Paul, before we let
please
you
please tell
go
us things that happened in the 18th century, Paul.
Not immediately.
discovery of Madagascar, wasn't it? 1712, Madagascar.
Madagascar. Is that real? Yeah. No, you're totally making
not
that
real.
Up.
Not
yeah,
real.
Okay, good. Yeah. Well, that sounds about right.
Don't know.
All right, we will see you next time. Be sure to check out History Rage, available wherever you can find great podcasts. Thank you again, Paul. And
thank you.
Toodaloo.
Just bye. Bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.